Welcome to Farced Perspective, a podcast about the last 50 years of comedy. On key anniversaries, we look back and ask, what was innovative material then? What continues to be successful now? And what have people thought about it along the way? I'm Ben, librarian and critic, and joining me once again is my co-host Anna, environmental scientist and analyst. Welcome back, Anna.
Thanks, Ben.
We join together again today to talk about the 1971 film Little Murders, which was released 50 years ago on the 9th of February. It has a troubled source history based on a play which famously closed after 7 performances in the 1960s. It was a very unusual candidate to be made into a film in the first place. It's about a particular family's relationship with the destruction of society, the slow, creeping, inevitable death of common courtesy and the problem with living in a city is sort of the heart of the theme of the picture. Now, I mentioned that it was based on a play written by Jules Pfeiffer, his first play. Jules Pfeiffer, who we previously encountered as the illustrator of the book The Phantom Tollbooth. This film was and eventually the directorial debut of Second City comedian and well-regarded actor Alan Arkin. Stars Elliot Gould, previously in this parish of the feature film MASH. Anna, what's your take on Little Murders?
I think this was probably one of my favorite movies that we watched so far.
I'm so relieved to hear that. I have a lot of problems with the third act, which we will obviously come to as we discuss the film. But as I was watching this is a film I've never seen. I came to this completely cold with a reasonable amount of trepidation because it holds no cachet except for the title, like the title and the basic concept that there can be a little murder, that some murders are important and some deaths don't matter. That has trickled down into the conceptual vernacular. But aside from that, the fact that this was so absent on the landscape, I was really worried that this was going to be a huge dud. We were letting ourselves in for a lot of trouble. And as I was watching it, I thought repeatedly, oh my gosh, I think this might be my new favorite movie.
Yeah, I would definitely enjoy watching it again. I think I probably will have some similar ideas to you about the third act, or at least some agreement. But I gotta say, I think there's like one classic shot of like Elliot Gould on the subway covered in blood that's sort of like a promotional shot. And I didn't even watch the preview, but you were like, hey, we can do this movie or this movie. And I went and took a look and I was like, Elliot Gould, blood on the subway. Yes, we're watching this one. Such is my love for Elliot Gould after MASH.
He'd just been in Bob and Ted and Carol and Alice prior to this. This was the height of his heyday. The DVD of this movie, which has one of the worst interior menu art I have ever seen, must have come out around 2008, 2009, and they were really leaning into the murders part of it. And so they have this grungy digital artwork nonsense of him like spiraling. Can you picture the cover of the film I Shot Andy Warhol?
Maybe.
It's the photograph of the shooter, and then her silhouette jumps off her in sequence in multiple different colors.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
And it uses that same technique for a photograph of him. And then behind him is like this ratty, dirty subway, and all the menus are selected with gun sight targets, and it's like, violence, yeah! And I'm like, this is not that movie. This is not Killing Zoe. This is not Suicide Kings. This is not a post-Tarantino Miramax knockoff movie. This is a very different kind of musing on violence. And so I'm interested that that's how they tried to sell it now. That's how they tried to sell it in the recent past when they were trying to sell it on home video. Whereas what you saw, the still of Gould in the subway covered in his wife's blood and everyone else just being like, whatever, we're just on the subway, none of this matters to us, is a completely different kind of marketing. I mentioned that only because I have the press book for the movie from 1971, the original document that was sent out to newspapers to get them to think about how to advertise it. And as you can see, the readers can't, but Anna can sort of see on camera, it highlights his illustrations. You get the drawings on the bottom of the poster that are done in his sketchy life style. It's really trying to get people who like his cartoons to come to the film. That and a still of Gould and Sutherland together in Sutherland's 10-minute cameo in the middle of the film.
Sutherland was just great.
They're playing on that MASH connection. So much in the same way that we're interested in revisiting that chemistry, they were also very much aware of that same dynamic, that if they could get a print ad that showed the two of them together, people would show up thinking, oh, excellent, let's get a nice little MASH reunion.
Well, I think in some regard it was effective. Like, I laughed my way through the first, I don't know, 7/8 of the movie. Mm. And then the last 1/8 of the movie, I was just staring at the screen, very distressed.
Let's get into that. Let's talk about the structure and the essential plot so that then we can talk about it in chunks and our reactions to it. Anna, do you want to summarize the plot for our audience who may or may not have seen it?
Yeah, we open with our main female lead.
Patsy.
Yes, Patsy. It's hard for me to summarize because there's like a few things that happen like one after the other in the beginning. And it's all so interesting. And I watched the beginning twice. But she meets Alfred, who is getting beat up. And she intervenes to save him. And he walks off. And then people who are beating Alfred up turn their attention to Patsy and start beating her up. And I mean, Alfred doesn't do anything. And once she extracts herself from the fight, she runs after Alfred and it starts yelling at him about, like, why didn't you help me? Like,
that was absolutely the most spineless. Are you a man or I don't know what you are? I don't know.
You shouldn't have done that. They were getting tired. You got them mad.
And despite her being incredibly angry at him, they strike up a romance. Patsy aggressively pursues Alfred, and Alfred is very reluctant. He's like, I don't know what love is. And Patsy's like, I'm going to marry you.
At which point she brings him home to meet her parents.
Her insane family, her parents and her her wacko brother, her wacko younger brother, who are this sort of grotesque caricature of a family that is... And this is the thing that I struggle most with the movie that I sort of was digging for in the last couple of days to see, like, what is the satire that is trying to be portrayed here? It's like the dad is like this really over-masculine, rigid character who's like, don't call me Carol.
Right. So, yes, the Nyquist family, the father's name is Carol, which to me is a perfectly good, you know, Slavic, Polish first name if spelled with a K. But in this regard, is spelled with a C. There is a famous actor whose name is Carol, maybe in All in the Family? I think the actor who plays the patriarch in that is named Carol. I should know this. But, you know, so there are male Carols out there that have overcome the incipient feminization of their names. But yes, he frequently brings up the fact that he never, like, however long he's been married to his wife.
Right, and yet she can't stop calling him Carol, and he can't stop, right, like, barking at her, like,
and don't call me Carol. I hate that name. I told you never to call me that name. You deliberately do that to annoy me.
However many years this has been going on for, because Patsy at one point says that she's 27 and that she has a slightly older brother who is now dead. So, you know, we can imagine that they've been together, potentially, that this has been an ongoing emasculation, nominative emasculation for over 3 decades.
Yeah, and that the mother may be doing it on purpose, because we see her doing, like, lots of, like, slightly passive-aggressive digs, like, throughout the movie, alongside her extremely saccharine aphorisms, these sort of nonsensical, like, meaningless, oh, like, why curse the darkness?
How far better it is to strike a match than curse the darkness. My mother always told us that. Go on, dear.
That's interesting. I didn't think that is part of her characters that she does. She has a bunch of sayings for different occasions, these pat cliche ways of dealing with the world.
My mother taught me to take dainty little steps. She'd kill me if she could see the stride on Patsy.
There's an extended speech. You alluded to a scene earlier when you did a wonderful imitation of Gould yelling, "I don't know what love is." that happens as he's literally on a horse.
It's so
riding
good.
Away from Patsy. And that happens just after Patsy has gone on a long tirade talking about how the world is crap, but she puts a brave face on it anyway.
You know how I wake up every morning of my life with a smile on my face. And for the rest of the day, I come up against an unending series of challenges to wipe that smile off my face. The breather calls, ex-boyfriends call to tell me they're getting married. Someone tries to break into the apartment while I'm getting dressed.
I still say today is going to be a good day, that I make it better through a force of will and positive thinking.
For every bad thing,
there are four good things.
She's bound and cynically determined to make the world a better place, even though it's not going to be. And you can definitely see that that's the kind of person who comes out of a family where the matriarch is somebody who has a fortune cookie positive spin on everything. It didn't occur to me at the time because it's better to light a single candle than to curse the darkness is one of my favorite Peanuts cartoons. Where there's a solid black panel with Charlie Brown in it, and Linus, ever the quoter of the Bible, comes up and says that line. So I don't know, but I've always assumed that it's a biblical verse.
Mm.
At which point Charlie Brown says, "Yes, but there are some people who disagree with you." And the fourth panel is a cut to Lucy, the angry, angry sister of Linus, yelling, "Stupid darkness!"
Yeah, and with the mom, sometimes the things that she says make sense and seem to line up with what's going on. And sometimes it's just sort of this nonsensical segue that she uses to redirect the conversation.
Yeah, to move on to happier thoughts, to try and control the chaos of her crazy family.
Yeah, and the younger brother, who is a very unsettling portrayal of a disturbed younger person, not really young, but also like satirizing what, I'm not sure. It falls somewhere between absolute hilarity and a figure who is extremely repellent, you know, where he's sort of sticking his tongue out of the side of his mouth and sort of leering at his sister. And like, we're not really sure like what exactly is going on in the family, but it's deeply unsettling while amazingly being very funny at the same time. Although I'm sure probably not everyone would find it so.
I agree with you. I had a difficult time zeroing in on the success or failure of the younger brother character. But there was one scene that really stood out to me. As they're just sitting down to dinner, the mother asks if Elliot Gould will open the window. And the father says, "I can get it," and goes over and immediately finds that the window is stuck and swears and goes back. And Gould is like, "You know, I can open the window. It's fine." He goes over and opens the window, and the father angrily tries to reclaim his masculine strength by saying, "I loosened it for you," which is
usually a joke, right, about pickle jars or whatever, right?
Right. But deadly serious. And the younger son, the younger brother, he's literally falling out of his chair thinking that this is so ridiculous. And the father storms over, shuts the window, heads back to the table and says, "Right, you go and open the window now." And the son walks over with this swagger, pretending to be the dad, swears, pulls vainly at the window, not even trying, just trying to mock how dumb the dad was for not being able to open the window, and heads back down to sit at the table. And if you watch the scene without paying attention to the action, you can see that Marcia Rod is the name of the actress who plays Patsy, and Elliot Gould are sitting at the table, and they're just doing their damnedest to laugh in character instead of to break entirely. They're sitting there and they're quietly smiling to themselves, and they're laughing a little bit behind their hands. And it's clear that they just think that this actor is going for broke in the most amazing way. And I don't know how many times they did that scene. I have no behind the scenes information about it whatsoever. But when I watched it a couple of times, I finally stopped watching him and started watching how much everybody else in that scene is like just absolutely corpsing at his antics.
I'm sorry I missed that, because that's one of my favorite things to catch in a scene.
He must have been a wildly fun, unpredictable, experimental actor to work with. And I did mention at the top that Alan Arkin came out of the Second City Improv and Sketch Group in Chicago. And if you purchase some of the anniversary retrospective things, there are sketches of him just doing straight up sketch comedy on the original recordings. And I think he was probably bringing some of that energy to the circumstances, probably encouraging his actors to go as broad as possible in order to see what would happen, to experiment and to figure out what the tone was later.
That's really fun. I hadn't thought about that. And this is his debut.
It is. Yeah. He directed some shorts, but not a full feature film before. And he directed the revival of this in the theater. So after it flopped on Broadway, within the next couple of years, he was able to revive it off Broadway, where it ran for 6 months to rave reviews. I have the memoir of Jules Pfeiffer here called Backing Into Forward. And he talks in the memoir in retrospect, saying, quote, "I had knowingly written a play not meant for the usual Broadway presentation, and then perversely had gone after a commercial comedy director who had the good sense to turn me down. I was hoping for, I don't know what, something experimental." So he tried to get classic comedians to direct it, but he needed somebody with a different sensibility. And so when it got revived off Broadway by Arkin, that's when it really, somebody else was able to bring a different kind of sense to it.
We got to walk people through the rest of the plot so they know what,
okay. Yeah.
What's so weird about it.
Right, because we haven't, aside from, as you say, that this family is very chaotic, and we'll get back to that after we have dealt with the rest of the plot. I apologize for cul-de-sacking in the middle of your speech. After he's met the family, they're walking home, and she's trying to get in a fight with him, trying to provoke him, and it's not working. So she grabs a phone in a phone booth and calls her parents and says, "We're getting married in a week." Then what happens?
You keep going.
Okay, you sure?
Yeah.
I just talked for like 5 minutes.
No, yeah, you keep going.
At which point, Gould grabs the phone and says, "However, there can't be any mention of God in the ceremony." They cut to an extended monologue by a judge in his chambers talking about how young people don't understand the purpose of God in society, that God is there for people who struggle. And so they abandon him and turn up at a church run by Donald Sutherland, who is running this hippie reactionary church that doesn't seem to have anything traditional in it.
Maybe your marriage will end, and that's okay. Maybe you'll cheat on each other, and that's okay too.
In a really bravura long, almost unbroken sequence.
There were so many of those in this movie, and it was one of the things that I loved the most. It's like,
interesting.
Asking the actors to take these monologues and really commit. I don't know. Is that word overused?
No, not at all.
And then to really stay with them, really go into these scenes, and they're not small conceptually or in terms of like what the actors have to do and bring to the characters. And it's, I feel like it's not as common anymore. I'm sure.
Definitely not.
Thank you.
The idea of a couple of pages of one person talking without any dialogue or any back and forth. And there are a number of scenes in this where you don't necessarily even get reaction shots. Sometimes you do, but there's a monologue coming up that we'll talk about where there's no cuts whatsoever.
Mm.
At which point, he reveals a couple of secrets at the end of the ceremony, and it turns into a fist fight in the church. Alfred assumes that the relationship is over, that their hour-long marriage is already done. At which point, Patsy shows up almost magically at the door and tries desperately one more time to get him to express himself or feel something, and doesn't get the reaction she's looking for and gives up. And when she is despondent and hopeless, he finally cracks, can't stand seeing her that way, and says that he will go track down his parents, from whom he's estranged, and try and figure out why he's so absent in his life. So he goes to Chicago and interviews his parents.
His dad greets him and talks to him as though, like, I don't know, no time has passed, or like, it's not strange at all that he's just showed up, that Alfred has just showed up after, like, who knows how many decades. And he sits down and he wants to record the questions that he is there to ask them. And they're like, we don't want to be recorded. That's weird. We feel weird about that. Like, you can ask us questions, but please don't. No recording. And he's like, I have to do this. And as somebody who's thought about asking my parents questions and recording their responses, I guess I took note. So, and then he asked them this series of questions about, like, you know, what was I like as a child? Was I a difficult child? Like, was I a good eater? I don't remember all the questions, but this sort of thing, you know, about the early childhood experience. And they respond with these very sort of Freudian, heady, abstract responses where they aren't even saying anything specific to him, just about the theory of childhood development. When he begins recording, he says, I can't really remember anything about my life before I'm 19. So I'm going to ask you some questions to help me, you know, understand, you know, why I am the way I am. So he sort of progresses through the questions and they start saying, I can't remember. You know, he's saying like, oh, what about this part of my childhood? And they say, I can't remember. I can't remember. I can't remember. Then we see him sitting at this table with the recording and he's listening back to it, and he lifts up his head and he goes into this monologue where he talks about having his mail read. He's like, I used to be much more of an activist, and so I started a correspondence with the person who is reading my mail. And he talks about basically like persuading this person into feeling like there was a conspiracy about them. Oh man, it was so interesting. If you're listening to this, you gotta go watch this movie. It was a great scene. It seems as though he's like maybe talking to the recorder or maybe talking to the flowers on the table. But then as the scene goes on, we realize that Patsy is actually in the background. They talk together and he's like, you know, I'm ready to feel now. I'm ready to like be the person that I am meant to be. Do you want to take it from here?
And upon becoming vulnerable, they embrace and she's shot by a sniper. At which point he then gets on the subway, goes to the parents and family's apartment, and is in a catatonic stupor for an unknown period of time. And nothing seems to help.
But they take care of him.
They take care of him. They feed him. They clothe him. They work in shifts trying to provide him with some sort of support and comfort. And as this happens, their apartment becomes more and more reinforced by steel gates on the windows and locks on the door, and it becomes clear that this is one of a huge number of random killings that has been taking place in the city. At which point we're visited by two detectives who are there to investigate. The police detective, as played by the director Alan Arkin, comes in and, yes, you guessed it, sports fan, delivers a long monologue where he talks about how all of these terrible unsolved murders are part of a conspiracy to remove trust in government and the police. And it's society falling apart specifically to destabilize our faith in institutions. At which point he paranoidly runs out of the apartment.
He absolutely decomposes during the course of his monologue. It's very good.
And at the end of it, Alfred gets up and leaves and wanders into Central Park and starts taking photographs. And he's unsettled and moved by this simultaneously. at which point he comes back to the apartment with a rifle. And then he and the younger brother figure out, with the help of Carol, how to load it.
Yeah, they don't know how to use it. And Carol comes over and shows them.
And one by one, they each shoot somebody randomly through the window. At which point, they're all reinvigorated, and they sit down together as a family to have dinner, wild and free and energized, like the family was when Patsy first visited them in the first act of the movie. And as sirens howl in the background, the mother says it's good to have everything back to normal, and that's the end of the movie.
What does it mean?
Well, surely you must have some theories.
Yeah.
Or because you must have been searching for something.
Well, honestly, the thing that stood out most strongly was the arc between Alfred and Patsy. Mm. Alfred is really struggling to feel, you know, he describes himself as an apathist. Mm-hmm. He's very reluctant to connect or engage. You know, he lets himself be beat up. But ultimately, he does warm up to Patsy, and he engages very strongly. He lets himself be loved, and then she dies. She doesn't just die. She's murdered, right? As soon as he, like, engages fully in their love, which, you know, she's sort of aggressively pursued him, which I think is a cultural trope that is really loaded in a lot of ways. Mm. But ultimately, we see him, like, warmly moving towards her. Again, itself very complicated, because this comic artist is known to have this, like, quote-unquote nebbish character.
Bernard, I think, is his most famous nebbishy recurring character in The Voice.
Right. So it's like, what is the message here? Like, what level of agency does Alfred have? Or is he just, like, moving through everything? We see him humming when he's getting beaten up. He talks about how mm-hmm. he hums through getting beaten up.
Muggers tend to get very depressed when you hum all the while they're beating you up.
Then he hums through meeting Patsy's family. He hums through the wedding. So at the end of it, like, do we see him transforming and really engaging with Patsy? Or is this just another moment where he's passively accepting his fate? I would argue the former. That he is experiencing a true transformation. I think that's part of what he's describing when he's talking about the letters that he was sending to this person, and, like, what he felt like his original purpose was before he lost his sense of himself in the world.
Patsy, you can't be the one to change. I'm the one who has to change.
However,
he gets there, if I can
guess
where you're going.
He gets there, and then Patsy dies. He learns that vulnerability serves no
purpose.
That's
not what I was going to say.
Oh.
I was jumping forward to the very last scene. When he finally, you know, he's hurt, he goes back into his shell, but he comes out again. He comes back out, fulfilling the role, taking the place of Patsy in her family. By uniting them all together, by interacting with society in the worst way possible. That the way in which they're able to find normalcy again, the way in which they're able to conquer fear, is by being part of the random violence that hurts other people.
Mother of God! Oh! You got him! Oh!
My boy!
Was that Patsy's role in the beginning, or was that just the way that they found to come together after her death?
It's not explicit in the text, but symbolically, it feels like Patsy is the thing that holds the family together after the death of the older brother.
Mm-hmm.
They're so excited to see Patsy when she shows up. They're so hyped up for her to come home. There's this amazing little dance that the father does, sort of like standing in place with his feet up and his hands going, like running in place like Barney Rubble. When she comes in, chanting her name over and over again, and the mom is like, there's this clutch of an embrace, and she runs in and starts sort of fake punching him. The way in which dads play with their sons in a mock violence. And when her younger brother runs in, she judo flips him onto the floor and starts grabbing his face and pinching his cheeks.
My baby brother! Oh, you're so cute. I can just eat you alive.
She is the aggressive hometown football son in this family.
It's true. It is true. It's a good take.
And we don't have anything that says that she did this because the older brother was killed, but she is clearly filling a role that is not normative in terms of cultural expectations, and there is an absence at the top.
Mm-hmm.
And when the mom says everything's back to normal.
Oh, you don't know how good it is to hear my family laughing again. You know, for a while there, I was really worried.
The family has restored that energy with Alfred grabbing the father and the brother, leading them in participation. The energy and the chanting and the eating comes about because now he's fulfilling the role of the football hometown hero eldest son, because the two other positions had been violently vacated and the younger son in the family can't step up.
Right. And so the point is that violence gives way to more grotesque violence and distortions of, you know, like people aren't okay, right? Like the mom doesn't mean that, like things aren't actually back to normal or healthy or all right.
No, definitely not healthy or all right.
But like the thing that fills the void after like this extreme violence that's been happening in the city, like, or in the movie, is more distortions and more violence. And that's the thing that comes in the wake of violence. Is that what's...
To a degree. So as you said, so what is Alfred's most primary characteristic in the first two thirds of the movie? Because he's an apathist, and therefore how does he react to every situation?
He doesn't react. He's absent. He's
a human Gumby. He just... Everything, every punch just absorbs, refuses to engage. His whole way of dealing with beating up is he just waits for it to be over.
Right.
One of the things that infuriates Patsy about him so much is that he won't fight with her.
I feel!
You don't feel!
Have it your way!
Ah, there you go again! You won't fight!
But you knew I wouldn't fight before you married me!
Classic.
She's always trying to pick fights and argue with him, and one of the things that she says is, I can't change you if you're just going to not engage. I don't think I've got the perfect quote here, but it's such a marvelous line. Here's the line, I found it. She says, basically almost to camera,
he doesn't know how to fight, that's why I'm not winning.
Oh man.
Because all of their conversations are a human Tai Chi match where he just redirects her energy away from him and doesn't engage.
Damn it, Alfred, aren't you willing to battle over anything? Even me?
There isn't much point, is there?
Well, at least say you love me. I'm not sure I know what love is. Okay, Buster, you've had it.
But at the end, he's finally engaging.
Mm-hmm.
The transformation of a person who, because when she starts becoming passive, when she becomes unresponsive, he's worried.
No more reason for anything.
Come on, cut it out.
The only true feeling is no feeling. The only way to survive.
And therefore goes out and finds the emotional reason to care again. The world then hurts him, and instead of closing down, he swings violently the other way. And become somebody who is now the person who acts. It's irresponsible, it's dangerous, it's destructive, but at least it's something.
I really wish that I knew what.
Well, I mean, it's not supposed to be healthy. That's why it's a satire.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't a good answer. It's a terrible answer. But that's the joke. The joke is, well, that's the only thing you can do in a world that doesn't work anymore.
Yeah. It's interesting because there's no good characters in this movie. There's only sort of interesting characters. You know, like Donald Sutherland's character. Like, that's not a good character. Like, that's not, you know.
He's totally a good character.
No. Like, we might like him because he's fun and he's bad, but, like, he's not.
He says
like, the stuff
nothing
that he
that's
says,
wrong.
No. The stuff that he says isn't healthy or okay. Yeah, okay. For the listeners, Ben is folding his arms and he's pouting.
I am doing both of those things. How can you possibly say that anything he says is wrong?
Any step that one takes is useful, is positive, has to be positive because it's a part of life. Even the negation of the previously taken step is positive. That, too, is a part of life.
He's saying everything is okay. It's silly. It is satire. It's making fun of people who are nihilists. Or nihilist, if you prefer. But everything is okay, so I can say it however I want.
Which is perfectly all right. Really, it is.
It's definitely like fun and indulgent, especially, you know, if you're somebody who rejects a classic church marriage. For our listeners.
Okay. Who's got two thumbs and rejects? Yes.
Right. Yeah. So, I mean, there's like certainly an appeal to Donald Sutherland's character. But like when he goes down the whole list, I just feel like most reasonable people would feel like, no, not everything is okay. You know, like anyone who has a philosophical bone in their body with a little bit of morality would be like, no, you know, not everything is all right. It's not okay to do just whatever anytime you want.
If I were a better person, I would be able to identify the type of philosophy that that is. But I know it's part of the ethos that was practiced by Aleister Crowley and his followers, which is nothing is forbidden, everything is permissible.
But even in that, you're supposed to not harm anyone.
Mm-hmm. And as he very specifically says, I can't believe I'm having a philosophical argument.
Yeah, what are we, 13? God. Can you talk about
Aleister
Crowley?
Donald Sutherland's fictional character is the basis for my point of view. But the basic premise being that you can only be hurt by that which you allow you to hurt you, I think is a very psychologically sound thing to say, that you are only your... I mean, and his character, Gould's character of Alfred, does that badly. He does that by saying, I will shut myself off from feeling anything, that I will be punched and kicked and savaged, and I will say it doesn't hurt, even though it clearly does, because I will refuse to acknowledge that it hurts. But from a self-help, from a psychological and trauma perspective, it's legitimate to say, don't give power to other people to hurt you.
And they, see, I'm not going to fall down. They get tired and they go away. It's hardly worth talking about.
You can reduce the ability of other people to hurt you. That's a legitimate way to prevent other people from being able to make you into a victim.
But I would say also that part of having connections and relationships and attachment to other people is part of the vulnerability that creates the opportunity to be hurt by other people. And so it's hard to have the one without the other.
And you're right. And I'm being swayed by the fact that it's Donald Sutherland and he's hilarious and charismatic. But this is a satire. Yeah. And so structurally, he says things that are acceptable at an 8, but he says them at an 11.
To more marriages, fine. As many as one wants, fine. To homosexuality, fine. To drug addiction, I will not put it down. Each of these is an answer for somebody.
And that tempered, they're fine, but taken to the nth degree, they're crazy. And similarly, this is structurally in a movie out of a play that is built so that the second somebody is vulnerable, the worst possible thing that could happen to them happens to them.
Yeah. And I thought it was interesting that all of these monologues are about, they're like half right. Like the one that came before about like believing in God. And like this guy goes on this long diatribe about, you know, you don't believe in God, but you've never like experienced suffering, and you don't know what it's like to like show up in this country and have nothing.
What they had in common was persecution. Persecution. So they weren't so glib about God.
I was like, oh yeah, guys got a point. Like people really suffer, and like, yeah. I was like, wait a second. No, I don't think that at all. But why? That's what I mean about like half right.
Mm-hmm.
I thought that was a very interesting way to run things. Right enough so you're like, oh yeah, I'm really here for this. Oh wait, no, what? Wait, what?
It's seductive. That it it creates reasonable points of view that are built in such a way that you understand the realistic character roots of the sort of person that would say them, but they're delivered in a bombastic or an absurdist manner that gets you to recognize, oh yeah, this isn't sustainable. Similarly, just the long paranoid diatribe by the detective, by Alan Arkin. I found that there was a lot of resonance in that with the current defund the police movement.
You know, Lieutenant, every time we pass a policeman, he hands him $5.
Well, I want the boys on the beach to know that someone still has faith in them.
Let us discuss. Go on.
So that when you have, I mean, there's the genes of QAnon in some of his statements. I'm reading some of the thing in front of me just now where it says,
who has the most to gain? People in high places, their names would astound you. People in low places, concealing their activities.
A far-reaching conspiracy to undermine respect for our basic beliefs and most sacred institutions, which is the environment this satirical take on New York City is built around. The idea that the city itself is fundamentally unsafe. And that you're just going to the grocery store could get you shot. We're all living in an environment right now where we're feeling like going to the grocery store is lethal from a different kind of projectile. And that fundamental destabilization of what is acceptably normal, you can hear the ring of truth in it. And it's only because it's delivered by Arkin in a stumbling, spitting, wide-eyed, feeble-minded way that you recognize you're not supposed to take the grain of truth of this and keep it in your heart.
What is the effect of 345 unsolved homicides? The effect is lack of faith in law enforcement personnel. Mm-hmm.
You're supposed to recognize that only somebody who's nuts would.
Right, and that it increased in its tension and volume over the course of his speaking. First, when he says that, oh, this is a conspiracy to undermine the institution, it's like, oh, that's interesting, is it? And then it's like, no. No, because that would make no sense to have 300 and some odd unconnected incidents actually be part of a concerted effort by whom exactly?
Right. It can't possibly be a concerted effort if it's 385 random incidents.
Right. And this is sort of while you're working this out on your own, he is also going all over the place, hitting every possible note forward and backwards. And so it's very easy to let yourself off the hook of that idea while he does it for you on the screen as well. But I think that's another really good example of a monologue that's just interesting enough, has just enough of an interest or a truth in it to be like, oh, huh. That's part of the reason why I got to the end of the movie and I was like, what is this actually about? What are they actually trying to say? Or who is the sympathetic hero? Or who are we trying to listen to? Because it's definitely chock full of nonsense. There's a little bit sort of woven throughout where it felt so that maybe there's a little bit about consumerism that we can take away and a little bit about violence, sure. But there was no crisp note throughout that seemed to really make a lot of sense.
No. I didn't see any reviews that focused on this, but regularly, when you watch movies that are based on plays, you tend to find critics that are saying, it really felt stage-bound, really felt like a play, and when you'd make a play into a movie, you need to work in order to explode it out so that it doesn't feel so set in one area. Pfeiffer, in the commentary track on the DVD, and in a few interviews. There's an interview you can find on YouTube with him talking after a screening of the film. Talks about the fact that everything up until when Patsy and Alfred arrive in the parents' apartment is brand new created for the film. And that the third act after the shooting is very, very different than the original play, because the original play being on stage was able to be abstract in a different way that a film wasn't able to create. And so he did a significant amount of adaptation to the text in order to find ways of illustrating aspects that were more taken for granted. The play itself is structured around that very common trope of somebody brings somebody home to meet the parents. And that person is wildly unacceptable. And yet, over the course of the play, somehow they're able to be normalized and reconciled into the family. So he's very much taking that trope of the meeting the parents, guess who's coming to dinner arc of showing the foibles of the family versus the outrageousness of the suitor and coming together in some kind of familial hegemony by the end of it. And turning it on its head in a couple of different ways. Mm-hmm. That's the structural bones of the play. The beginning, therefore, all that stuff about going to the Concord and like the dancing and the tennis and all that superficial suburban awfulness that she subjects him to in order to find out if he's an okay suitor, to try and make him feel alive.
You don't have to do anything you don't want to do.
Except have fun.
You'll get used to it.
That is very much built on sort of social commentary on what might somebody who's awful think is important. Similarly, while the extended sequence of her waking up, there's that really interesting series of shots of she's making breakfast and she's just turned on the shower and all this rust has come out of the pipes. And so you see it going down the drain.
Oh, rust. I was like,
why? It looks like blood.
This scene of blood in the shower.
Yeah, no. At which point it cuts to her pouring powdered Tang in a cup and then pouring powdered coffee in another cup and then pouring powdered creamer into the coffee. And so it's powder into water four times in a row, and it just heightens this kind of terrible artificiality of that's what your life is. Garbage dissolved into water instead of anything real. What a wonderful, tight piece of observational satire that doesn't connect to anything else in the movie.
Yeah, or does it? I mean, like, are we to be criticizing Patsy and her...
Yes. And her bourgeois, tacky family? Yes.
Well, yeah, no, I mean, I think that there's a lot to be said that we have said and are about to probably say more about, but about how awful she is and how annoying she is and her family, obviously. But there are also like things that I really liked about her, but I'm not sure if I only like that from a modern context.
Well, I think it's got to be both. Anybody who enters into a relationship, this is what I've been saying for as long as I can remember. Anybody who enters into a relationship with the specific desire to change the other party in the relationship, that is the reddest of red flags. That is the worst motivation. And she has that astonishingly wonderful line of,
I married you because I wanted to mold you. I loved the man I wanted to mold you into.
I think the most fun thing about her character is that she's super self-aware. Like, and in a lot of ways, not self-aware at all. But like the moments where she's just like extremely candid about her intentions.
She's so honest.
Yeah, it's the only way that her character is fun.
Right. But she's not aware she's awful. She doesn't have the self-awareness to understand that what she's saying is the worst. But she's totally forthright about it.
Yeah, right. Or the moments where she's, you know, she's like, am I aggressive?
And she grabs his lapels, basically.
Like shoves him under the water.
You think I'm too aggressive?
I like it.
Somebody has to be aggressive. Do you like me?
I think you're terrific.
Are you attracted to me?
Come on, Patsy.
She's a hilarious character because she fits in exactly as the monologues do, where there's a germ of recognizable truth. There's a person in there that you like. You like the fact that she's upfront about what she wants. You like the fact that she's trying to get him to be more engaged with life. Those are both good qualities. She's great in a lot of wonderful ways. However, she's also unbearable because she is just like the monologues. She has a heart of believability, and then she's been cranked up so that your ears start to bleed emotionally. So I think you're allowed to like her because you're allowed to see the human parts of her, but you're also supposed to laugh at her because if you were actually in a relationship with that person, you would stop as soon as possible.
Well, I guess it's similar to Alfred, who is like also very likable in his own way, but also completely intolerable in his own way.
It isn't just pain.
thing you don't feel. You don't feel pleasure.
I do feel pleasure.
About what?
A lot of things.
Name one.
My work.
Oh, name another.
Sleeping.
Yes, 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 yes. All of the above. As you said, there's nobody that is actually a 100% emulatable good person in the film. In my earlier comments about the preacher, notwithstanding, because I'm wrong. I'm wrong. I admit it. I'm wrong. He appeals to my 16-year-old self, but you well and truly put me in the place of recognizing that, yeah, I do not support Aleister Crowley, and I should not support him if he looks like Donald Sutherland.
Well, I don't know why I always want things to be easy. I feel like on every episode we get on, I'm like, but what does it mean? Yeah.
Well, on that note, let's move on to the summary minute and the quiz.
I hope I win this time.
Why wouldn't you?
I don't know.
So the good people at random.org have seen fit to pluck 1 minute out of the air for Anna to review. She will have 60 seconds to watch the 60-second clip. Then she will only have half that time to summarize it. If she is able to get to the end of the summary in just a mere 30 seconds, then she will have a bonus point as we go into the trivia section. She'll be asked 5 questions, and if she's able to get the majority of them right, including the bonus point, then she has the great pride in knowing that I have not created a series of questions deliberately designed to make her feel bad about herself. So, the good people at random.org have, for today's selection, produced Minute 92. That's Minute 92.
We are involved here in a far-reaching conspiracy to undermine our most basic beliefs and sacred institutions. Who is behind this conspiracy? Once again, ask the question, who has the most to gain?
I'm not going to be able to do it. I'm going to be laughing too hard. Oh my God.
Interesting. And a new development. The idea that a comedy could still be fresh enough that it can affect your ability to summarize.
Oh my God, it's so good. And just knowing that Ellen Arkin was in the Second City and just puts like a whole different spin on this character.
Knowing that he then had to whip around behind the camera and review his own footage in the dailies and be like, how did I do? I don't know. I had the camera pointed at me. Gordon, how was it? Oh, wasn't, man, a bad Alan Arkin for a first time. All right, take a deep breath, and when you're ready, your 30 seconds will begin. Go.
We open on the detective Alan Arkin. He's saying, it's a conspiracy. There's people in high places. There's people in low places. He's describing, who would want this conspiracy? I'll tell you who. And he's slurring his words and he's stumbling backwards. And eventually he slams himself up against the doorway. He pulls out his guns and he's like, I'll have my people call your people. And we can barely understand what he's saying.
10 seconds left.
He flings open the door. He steps out backwards. The other detective steps into the frames and he says, I advise no
5 seconds left.
No one should leave town. And then he closes the door.
Done. Well done indeed. You got voices, you got character, you got drama.
I think I'm getting better.
I think you're owning it.
I think I'm cheating. I just get really fuzzy in the middle. I panic and I just speed through the middle of 40 seconds.
I think you should be proud of your victory.
No, thank you.
I spent a little bit of time considering whether or not I was going to research the legality of police departments being able to tell you can't leave town as the basis of, because I'm pretty sure that doesn't have any legal weight, but I forgot and instead focused on the line, we are readying mass arrests.
Oh yeah.
And so I am going to ask you 5 questions, starting with that as the initial concept and moving on from there.
Great. I'm excited. I'm going to ace this. I can tell. I'm basically a lawyer.
Question 1. Detective Practice nears the end of his rant, shrieking that they are readying mass arrests. What television police drama is named after the police station terminology for mass arrests? A. Code 37. B. Dragnet. C. Whipsaw.
Dragnet.
Correct.
Bam.
1949 radio play spinoff, a TV series in 1951. The radio series was created by actor Jack Webb, who fashioned the lead role of Detective Joe Friday for himself. Which of the following is untrue? A. Friday is a spinoff of a forensic investigator Webb played with a totally different name in the 1948 noir film He Walked by Night. B. He was parodied by the character of Kate Munday in the segment titled MathNet in Square One Television, a math-centric show by the production company behind Sesame Street. Or C. He continued to play the character in other films, notably in Dark City in 1950, as a favor to his Dragnet partner, Harry Morgan, and in a cheeky cameo in the 1998 film, also called Dark City, as William Hurt's retired partner and mentor.
A was made up.
No, he did, in fact, base it on a tiny role in He Walked by Night. He did team up with his Dragnet partner Harry Morgan in a 50 movie called Dark City, but they were very different characters.
Shout out to MathNet, I'm just saying.
100%, I loved MathNet. It was great.
So good.
I definitely wrote that question because I was excited to remember MathNet. Question number three. Mass arrests are found to be unconstitutional as they lack probable cause and were designated a war crime in 1944. However, two of the following three stories still happened recently. A. 700 students were arrested in 2004 during a mass sit-in of the UC Berkeley Administrative Building in protest of the war. B. A 2001 study showed that the Detroit Police Department was arresting three times as many people as was statistically parallel in other cities, probably to compel witnesses to give testimony under duress. Or C. Mike Pompeo released a statement condemning the arrest of more than 50 pro-democracy advocates in Hong Kong, saying that they had the right to demonstrate for freedom on the same day as the insurrection in the U.S. Capitol. Which one of those is not true? Correct. That happened in 1963, not in 2004. Question number four. The detective says that there have been 345 random homicides in the city in the past 6 months, all unsolved. In a 2018 study in the Washington Post, of the 1,345 homicides in D.C. in the past 10 years, how many remain without an arrest? A. 242, or 18%. B. 390, or 29%. C. 592, or 44%. Or D. 632, or 47%.
I think it's C.
Correct.
What did I tell you? I'm basically a lawyer.
Well, then, for our final question, let's change focus a little bit to something less legal and more obscure. Lieutenant Practice claims that some of the conspirators trying to destabilize society are, quote, concealing their activities beneath a cloak of poverty, unquote. Which Sherlock Holmes story features Neville St. Clair, spoilers, pretending to be a beggar outside an opium den instead of the high society man that he is? Is it in the story A, A Case of Identity, B, The Adventure of the Crooked Man, or C, The Man with the Twisted Lip?
A.
No, that would be too obvious. It's The Man with the Twisted Lip. Which means you got an unassailable 4 out of 5 questions correct. 3, but with a bonus point. And you are indefatigably tonight's winner.
I did it.
With bells on. Well, we'll close the episode as we usually do with our 5 favorite moments from the film. Just to recap, a moment is a line reading or a glance, an actorly gesture, not a whole scene, but just a piece of the film that makes us stop or think or consider or smile. Anna, why don't you give me one of your top 5 moments from Little Murders?
I really like the scene where they're on the horses together. And Patsy is trying to court Alfred.
court. I think you mean Shanghai. I think you mean Neg.
yeah, indeed. Yeah, so Alfred is trotting away from Patsy. And it is, yeah, the physical comedy in this movie is just like really at a peak for me. I don't know what's wrong with me, but it was really doing it for me. And Alfred trotting away on his horse that looks slightly too small for him as he says, I don't know what love is, with his like elbows out to the side, like bouncing up and down. It was hilarious.
I said, I think I'm falling in love with you. Alfred, are you falling in love with me?
I don't know what love is.
I'm going to, for my second moment, bring up the what we mentioned briefly when we were talking, doing the overall summary, that at the very beginning of the film, Patsy picks up the phone and there is a salacious, heavy breather on the other end of the line, which is a weird 70s trope that I've never understood. Like, I'm aware of the fact that it's a perversion that somebody's just turned on, that he's talking to a woman and the woman's disgusted that he is getting off by the fact that she's disgusted by him. Like, I've never believed it. I've never believed that this was the thing that actually happened, except for the fact that it's so pervasive in pop culture. It's in so many comedies, it's in so many Mad magazines, that it must have been real, I guess. The arc of it that goes from he calls at both her apartment and at the family home, that he follows her around. I think he calls 7 times over the course of the film, including once at the church when her younger brother picks up. And then finally at the end, the father says, she's dead, so stop calling. And he calls back and says,
I don't know what to say. I'm terribly sorry. But what can we do? The world's gone crazy.
But the part that I loved the most was right before we get the judge, we have a little precursor of his point of view, because the father picks up the phone and yells,
you young people today, destroy, destroy, when are you going to find time to build? In my days, we couldn't afford telephones to breathe in. You want to get down your hands and knees and be grateful.
Oh my God. I don't know why I love this movie so much. It just really hits.
Well, because he's before he was a playwright, he was a comic strip writer. And it's such a good series of observational comics. And this is what I was getting into earlier when I was talking about critics always point out that you can see the bones of a play in some movies that aren't successfully exploited. I couldn't help but review this as a series of Village Voice strips. And I didn't see anybody write that. I saw no reviews that were like, every monologue was clearly one of Pfeiffer's trademark soliloquies that his comic characters in The Voice would do. They would basically talk either to themselves or directly to the reading audience. And I kept on waiting for myself to get frustrated with that. Kept on waiting for me to be like, God, another monologue? But every time it started to happen, I was like, oh yeah, here we go. Because he's such a good observational humorist. He's so good at observational satire. And every time he found both a character and a twist at the end. It's exactly like his strips. And so it might be one of the most successful, even though it's not based on a comic strip, it felt more like a good adaptation of a comic strip into a series of comics that he would have written into a film than so many films that are based on comics ever do. Like, it's sort of the equivalent of a Charlie Brown special, where you can feel the comic book structure being built into a screenplay. What's your third moment?
My third moment, man, I just love that scene with Alfred at the table when he's talking about messing with the guy who's reading his mail.
Dear sir, I'm not that different from you. All men are brothers. Tomorrow, instead of reading my mail in that dark, dusty hall, why not bring it upstairs where we can check it out together?
I just felt like that was such a turning point in the movie, like for his character, for him and Patsy, also for the tone of the movie. I felt like it had been like this very carnival, sort of bizarre, grotesque satire vibe up until that moment. And then we see him with his parents. And then right after that, we see this scene when it's like very quiet, very dark, except for him and the way that they, like, he's lit. And there's a lot of quiet and like solemnity to that. And also,
I'd like to take the moment to shout out the cinematographer, Gordon Willis, who's most famous for being the man who lensed the Godfather movies. And I think that that sensibility that he brought to that shot of Patsy in the darkness so that you don't even know she's there for so much of it, and for Arkin's trust in the camera not moving until that final bit. It's, I mean, that, what a brave thing to do, is to just trust that the audience is going to go along with you with no flash, no reactions, just solemnity and absurdism.
I thought it was really brilliant. And I also thought it brought together like a couple of things that had been coming alive in the movie up to that point where, you know, like in the opening scene, we hear slurs about homosexuality. Like later on, we see that there's like racial tension going on when Patsy's apartment has been broken into. So there's like these undercurrents of like the political backdrop to the movie. And then Alfred sitting at the table, he's, you know, he's telling the story of how he used to be an activist. And he's talking really frankly about government surveillance, which is not a conspiracy. You know, like there's conversations about conspiracy sort of woven through the rest of the film, which felt very now. But in this particular context, it wasn't, it's not an exaggeration. You know, people had their mail read. Activists were, you know, tapped, like wiretapped and followed. And and so that connection to the active history of that time felt surprisingly sober in light of the rest of the movie. And I loved it. I thought it was very interesting.
The fact that it reflected and pulled in a political reality has to be part of what makes it successful as the emotional turning point of the movie. That if that didn't work, we wouldn't believe that he would try. That he was affected by Patsy's shutdown, so much so that he reached out to his parents, and he was so unfulfilled by what they gave him that he decided to stop being the product of that and try to be somebody new for this woman that he loved, which has to happen in order for her death to mean something. It has to be the most important thing to him, and it wouldn't work if he was the character he'd been up in the previous 45 minutes of the film. For my number four moment, I love the way the setup of the scene with the judge happens. That they're in his chambers and he's talking, and after he's put on his robes, he walks out and they're just left sitting there listening to his voice booming away.
Who could they ask for help? If not God, then who? The Great Society? The Department of Welfare? Travelers in Aid?
And they sort of look at each other like, wait, are we supposed to follow? And you get a good minute of them wandering through hallways, listening to his ongoing monologue, not knowing where he is until they eventually step into court and find that he's just in an empty court talking to them, even though they're not there yet, and a court reporter transcribing everything that he's saying. It's such a... You talk about the fact that... I talk about the fact that there are things that work in a play and work that you need to reimagine in order for them to be on screen. It was such a beautiful way, like they took advantage of that courthouse in such a fun and gorgeous, like the visuals of them wandering through that arched corridor with the echoes. I loved the, what felt like the joyful happenstance of the physical location that they were in, plus giving them something to do while this guy was going on and on and on about the hardship of the previous generation. It gave them a moment to be funny as well, which isn't probably in the script. You know, they're just there to be lectured. And so it gave them an additional layer of funny on top of it. And I thought that that was probably only in the direction. And it was such a clever thing for Arkin to have brought to that scene to make it alive and to give it more things to do.
That was also one of my favorite scenes.
Why don't you bring us home with number five?
So for my final scene, I would say the Donald Sutherland's character, the minister, was absolutely fantastic.
It would be, I mean, come on. We could have done all five moments from that script. There were so many good pieces in that scene.
Say one. Say one of your favorites.
Okay. I liked that by the time he actually gets to the vows, he says,
Patricia and Alfred, to dwell on while I ask you these questions required by the state of New York to legally bind you. Sinister phrase, that.
It was like, so that, good.
That quality he had of commenting on and like experiencing the words in real time. It's a thing that I feel often, that I say words, and as I say them, I hear a projection of what they might sound like in somebody else's ears, and I can't stop myself from sniping at them and deconstructing them as I'm saying them, which makes for a very disjointed listening experience, I'm sure. But that's, I recognized a kindred brain in that, those series of moments, in the way in which he can't just read the words, he has to comment them on the same time. You said you were about to say something about Donald Sutherland.
People say that my dad looks like Donald Sutherland.
Does he have the beard?
No, not that version of Donald Sutherland.
The current undoing version of Donald Sutherland, the clean-shaven patrician version.
Well, I don't know. Now that I'm saying it out loud, I'm worried that I've made it all up. But every time I look at Donald Sutherland, I think about my dad, my sweet hippie dad. Yeah, and I like thinking about this era of, you know, where like, you know, in one scene they were this, you know, hippie, not so much free love, but you know, this nihilist vibe where he's just like, yeah, man, like whatever is fine, like really, no, literally whatever. And I just like that this character would have resonated with so many people in that era, or not just resonated, but like pissed off a lot of people in that era when they're like, no, you're making fun of us.
Yeah, it's hard to say. I mean, because I definitely resonate with his whole bit that ritual is sham, and that he loves that the ceremony is an abandonment of ritual.
As this ceremony connotes an abandonment of ritual in the search for truth.
Like, that's my jam, baby. That's my ethos.
I love that you're so into this character who is, like, supposed to be a made-up person to make fun of other people. I'm going to tease you forever about this.
But yes, I agree with you that if it works, fine. If it fails, fine. Is a disastrous basis for a relationship.
Just try a little.
And ultimately, yeah, that's her counter argument to him. I don't know, how did you read her response when she actually had to say her part of the vow? She can barely croak out a yes.
Well, I think everything was so off the rails at that point, and like her whole way of being in the world was to exert control over everything.
And this ceremony was very much not her. It was very much Alfred.
Her reluctance in the wedding, I think, is just like another part of this character shining through, where like she's only going to thrive as long as she's sort of running the show.
Now, I'm not saying that I'm any better or stronger than you are. It's just that you and I have different temperaments. And my temperament is better and stronger than yours!
Which might go back to what you were saying earlier about how she's sort of this masculine character that, I don't know, is thriving as the son who wasn't.
I'm about to say something terrible.
Uh-oh.
I think there is one good relationship in the movie.
Hold on, let me guess. The two detectives.
It's Alfred's parents.
We don't see enough of them to say that.
But there's this...
It's
first
not
of all,
about
they're totally,
them. No, they're two fringe characters. No.
First of all, they're trash. They're terrible people. They're legitimately terrible people. Like, they're clearly academics. And their whole obsession with, like, young people. Like, they can't stop talking about young people.
There's a new David Smith show on at the museum.
The young people like David Smith?
Oh, we were supposed to go with Norm and Edie, but I was in the middle of a Vonnegut.
Young people adore Vonnegut.
They're clearly reading newspapers or something, and they're always like, well, this is what young people like to do, and therefore we'd like to do it too in order to find a... Like, and they're trying to get through these things.
I also read that as, like, they completely misunderstood. They, like, still thought of Alfred as, like, a young person.
As a kid.
Right. Yeah. But he's not. And, like, they were so checked out. Anyway, go on.
But at the same time that they're, like, so clued in with what young people do, like, probably because they've been reading all these studies and articles about it, and they're like, oh, we're very keen to be perceived of as hit and been trendy, despite the fact that we're past it, that there's this grasping intellectual fakery to their desire to be cutting edge. But when his dad goes over to the bookcase, it's right before he asks, like, did he have the right kind of food? And they both stop and they're like, food. Like, they're totally absent of the idea that they might have had to have fed their child. Before that, he says, well, Ferenczi's phrase about human development is, and she says,
Ferenczi's phrase.
Ferenczi.
And they look at each other, and there's this electric recognition of an erotic in-joke between the two of them.
Wow.
And they're so in love with each other in that moment.
Oh, my
God. And I'm just like, that is beautiful. That, like, these two old intellectuals, like, have this stupid academic in-joke between the two of them, and they're so into it. And the actors do such a good job of conveying that at the moment. Like, they're clearly made for each other.
Dear listeners, if this sounds good to you, you should definitely get in touch with Ben on Twitter.
I'm not saying it's what I want. I'm saying
it's what he wants.
It's what they want. No, I'm not saying that.
He'll never admit it, but.
How dare you?
It sounds ideal. That level of intellectualism and unspoken.
Nobody else in the film actually is a good match.
You know, and I didn't even pick up on it, which is part of the reason why I'm teasing you about it. You know, that you're able to, like, see that and, like, interpret all of the cues going on in that conversation. I was so focused on Alfred and, like, how devastated he must be, like, what was going to happen next in his story, because he's the main character. No, and you picked up on this, like, whole other something going on with these terrible people.
Yeah, I suppose there's probably something healthy in not finding good things about terrible people.
No, that's not what I'm trying to say.
You're better off than I am. Congratulations.
No, that's not what I'm trying to say at all. I think that's very interesting. And I'm curious to go back and see what else was happening in that scene.
Sorry, Anna. Are you saying you can't wait to watch this again?
Shut up. Wow, called out. I was really going to try to not say that. But also, I opened with, this is the, like, my favorite movie that we've watched so far. So it did feel kind of like a Chekhov's gun situation where, like, I was going to get around to saying that I couldn't wait to watch it again. But you beat me to it, Ben. Thanks. Thanks for... It's okay. The next movie I'm going to hate on purpose just for you.
First Perspective was created and developed by Ben Russell and Nathan Emily. This episode was researched, recorded, and produced by the presenters. Editing by Ben Russell. Our logo is based on designs by Liana Emily. Thank you, Liana. The theme song was mixed from recordings of Silver and Cone's Yes, We Have No Bananas, sourced by Creative Commons clips from the archive.org community. You can find us at farceperspective.com and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at farcenamebasis. If there are things, facts, or data of any kind that you feel is incorrect, please contact us via the website, and we will post it to our errata page on Farce Perspective as soon as possible. This podcast is an intellectual exploration of comic phenomenon, and our discussion is purely in the name of academic interest and contributing to the common conversation. I'm Ben, my co-host is Anna, and we'll see you next time when we discuss another comic touchstone celebrating a key anniversary.